There is a large number of Christians, and perhaps especially a large number of college and university students who are Christians, or were, who have abandoned their Christian faith because they came to believe that it was unscientific. They were persuaded that our fundamental convictions as Christians, that God created the world, that Adam and Eve were his special creatures, that the Bible is a reliable source of information about God, man, history, salvation. All of this has been shown to be untrue. Now, there's nothing particularly new about any of this. A great many of the standard objections to the Christian or biblical account of reality are by now very old hat. A great many of them were raised by critics of the Christian message in the ancient world, who likewise argued that the resurrection didn't happen, couldn't have happened, and that the miracles couldn't have happened, that the Bible therefore couldn't be trusted, and so on. In the modern world, since the beginning of the so-called Enlightenment in the 17th century, doubts rooted in a so-called scientific view of the world are broadly of two kinds. Perhaps more than anything else, the theory of evolution has undermined Christian faith as it provides an account of the origin of the world and of human life that does not require God. And in a way that confirms the modern suspicion that the whole idea of religion is nothing but a primitive effort to explain, understand, and control nature. Such a view strikes at the very root of religious belief of any kind, but directly at the Bible's claim that the world and everything in it, including us, are the creation of an infinite personal God, and that we human beings were made in His image and likeness, and so are what we are, because we were made for relationship with God and with one another. If all of reality and human nature as part of it are actually one remarkable accident, very little of the biblical account of reality will survive. I remember years ago reading a missionary letter from Marc Mayeux when he was still an MTW missionary in France, saying that he despaired of many Frenchmen coming to Christ until the grip of the theory of evolution on the French mind was finally broken. I want to deal with this objection to the Christian faith and the authority of the Bible next Lord's Day evening. A second area of so-called scientific attack on the Christian faith is that of the authority, the trustworthiness, the historical integrity of the Bible itself. Can we trust its account of human history, the history of Israel, and supremely its account of the life, ministry, death, resurrection, and ascension of the Lord Jesus Christ? As you know, a large number of academic types have argued over the past several centuries that we can no longer believe the Bible. It is this challenge to the Christian faith I want to consider this evening. It's, of course, an immense question. It can be got at from a great many directions. This evening, I can only give you some sense of the whole. I told you last Lord's Day morning that I was reading George Marsden's biography of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, a book that has been immensely influential over the past half century or so in bringing men and women to Christ. Think of Charles Colson or Francis Collins, or confirming and strengthening the faith of people who were already Christians. Think of J.I. Packer. But what I hadn't known, and I suspect you probably didn't know, is that when the radio talks were first presented during the Second World War by the BBC, and when they were first published in book form, there were a number of scathing reviews. And chief among the themes of those criticisms, personal attacks really, was that Lewis was presenting an impossibly old-fashioned and out-of-date view of the faith based on a discredited view of the Bible. Even so-called Christian reviewers panned the book for being unscientific, presenting an argument that ignored what we now know about the origin of religion and of the Bible. In more than a few of the critical reviews of Lewis's work, reference was made to the fact that Lewis had contradicted the consensus of modern scholarship. As an aside, it's interesting to me, it's important for you to know that a great deal of what such people thought they knew about the Bible in the 1940s has largely been discredited. Even liberal biblical scholarship has moved on to a new set of arguments against the historicity and authority of the Bible. Biblical scholarship, especially of the liberal type, is as faddish and likely of revision as any other area of human learning, though skepticism toward the Bible remains through it all. Actually, even in the 1940s, this sort of criticism was hardly new. Indeed, it parroted an ancient narrative. For centuries now, the claim has been made that the religious view of the world, and the biblical view in particular, is unscientific, has been disproved in certain particulars, is unworthy of the educated mind because it can't be held without a person abandoning his or her reason and crucifying his or her intellect. And of course, as you know, this has for some time been the majority view on the campuses of American colleges and universities. So much so that a considerable number of professors on those campuses will happily acknowledge that their educational task is to disabuse their students of the teaching of the Bible, of the credit they still invest in the Bible, the teaching and the credit in which they were raised. And they have proved effective in that task. Accurate statistics are hard to come by, and as usually is the case, the claims that Christian kids lose their faith in college are overblown, but no one doubts that many do lose their faith during those years, and that contempt for historic Christianity on college and university campuses is an important contributing factor. I know people who lost their faith during their college years and for whom the antagonism toward that faith on the part of their professors was a major cause of their loss of confidence in the Bible. It's not easy for a college student to see through the pretensions of an impressive university professor or to be able to answer the objections he or she raises to the faith, objections that sound so learned upon first hearing and seem so unanswerable. If, for example, the entire biology faculty at your university believes that it is proved or been proved that life evolved into its present forms by random genetic mutations, who is a 19-year-old student to say that all of them are wrong? When Richard Dawkins writes that Darwin, and so the theory of evolution, enabled him to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, who is a college student who knows almost nothing about biology or paleontology to contradict him? And when a biblical studies or history professor says that the biblical account is mythical or that this or that assertion of the Bible has long been known to be untrue, who is he or she to say it is not so? But it isn't just college students who feel the weight of the problem. Science seems so sure of itself, its authority now seems so firmly established in our culture, that many Christians who intend to remain Christians have thought it necessary to adjust the Christian faith to the scientific or scholarly consensus. The desire to conform our thinking to that of the world around us has always been one of the most powerful motives in human life. There's a reason why the American College or University Guild is perhaps the most conformist institution in our land. Christians have been doing this, by the way, for centuries, not simply in our day. There must be, they think, there must be a way to read the Bible in a way that does not conflict with what we are taught that science has now proved or science knows. But as history shows us repeatedly, if Christians can no longer take the Bible seriously at this point or at that point, it won't be long before an ever-increasing number of Christians conclude that the faith has sprung a leak and it's time to abandon ship, or that the foundations are crumbling and it can't be long before the house itself falls down. Many adult believers who started down that road of accommodating the faith to modern scholarship, sure at the time that they would and could maintain their Christian faith, eventually gave it up. Doubts about the Bible are an acid that over time must eat away at whatever is left of confidence in the Christian faith. Now, as we begin, it's important to identify precisely what we mean when we speak of science or of some area of learning being scientific. What those who use the terms mean by them is, of course, simply that something is true or it's factual. It is scientific if it conforms to reality, unlike the opinions people hold that they hold without adequate foundation. But obviously, as anybody knows who reads the newspaper or keeps his eyes and ears open, it isn't nearly so simple. What one person thinks is scientific, another equally learned person may think is hogwash. That is true in every area of human learning. It always has been. Unbelievers reject the scientific pretensions of other unbelievers every day of the week, including unbelieving biblical scholars. There are definitely things we know, things we have learned about nature and about the Bible. But surrounding that knowledge is a vast world of opinion about a great many things, and those opinions are scientific in the ordinary sense of the word only if they actually prove to be true. A great many of them do not. And many of those opinions, once confidently held, have now been discarded by virtually everyone. They were once touted as scientific. Now we know that they were simply wrong. So let's begin by defining our term. What is science? You may be surprised to learn that there has been and is today a vigorous and sometimes not entirely kind or polite debate about what science is among scientists. Opinions differ widely about what actually constitutes a science. Is mathematics a science, or is it simply a tool? Scientists argue about that. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, seems to be very scientific to most people today, so much so that we spend millions of tax dollars pursuing it. And many astrophysicists and evolutionary biologists are avid supporters of this expense. But other scientists, not Christians, equally learned, think the whole thing is a colossal waste of time and money. That the sponsors of SETI are less like scientists and more like the crackpots who claim to have seen a UFO. More than that, biologists, physicists, and chemists often don't think very much of sociologists or anthropologists or economists as scientists, even though all of them claim to be doing science. Sociologists covet the prestige that comes with being called a scientist. But is sociology or economics really a science? That water is a molecule, two parts hydrogen and one part oxygen, is certainly a different sort of claim than that the Great Recession was caused by a failure of the government to regulate the banking industry. What is science to one person is not science at all to another. So the terms we often hear, natural science, hard science, social science, or speaking of economics, the dismal science. Its practitioners may call the field political science, but as everyone knows, it's not scientific in precisely the same way that chemistry is. This is important for our consideration because there are a lot of different sciences And sciences of very different kinds that bear on questions of the reliability of the Bible and of the history that it relates. Is archaeology a science? Carbon dating is physics, but what about archaeology itself? And what about linguistics, lexicography, the study of words? And for that matter, what about history? And finally, while we all agree that chemistry and biology deserve to be called sciences, people in those fields will admit that errors are legion and often go uncorrected for long periods of time. The original meaning of the word is simply knowledge. But no one thinks that the biologist or the physicist is the only one who knows anything. Indeed, most biologists and physicists know a great deal about very little, such is the atomization and specialization of modern science, especially the hard sciences. Kerry is in biochemistry, and he is investigating the protein molecule. Well, that's not exactly right. He's investigating parts of the protein molecule. Well, no, that's not exactly right either. He's investigating little pieces of parts of the protein molecule. In fact, he's investigating one little piece of one little part of a protein molecule that actually has millions of pieces and parts. Ask Kerry about orchids or chimpanzees or carbon dating, and he's likely to give you a blank stare. What he knows is these little tiny pieces of parts of protein molecules. That's science in the modern world. In fact, as Philip Johnson very wisely pointed out in some of his writing, the most learned scientist in his field is in fact an amateur in every other part of the scientific enterprise. Probably has no more authority in his judgment than you and I do, who know almost nothing about those other areas of science. Most people, and I think fairly, imagine science to be the pursuit of knowledge by observation, experimentation, research, measurement, careful thought, and so on. In that sense, science is simply learning, the rigorous investigation of various subjects. Such knowledge built up piece by piece over time eventually makes possible whole areas of knowledge and sometimes even an understanding of natural laws. And of course, that sort of science has been with us for a very long time. A good bit of the knowledge of the ancient world was scientific in that sense and led, as science does today, to generalizations that some that prove accurate and some that prove not to be. The ancients knew from careful observation and calculation, for example, that the earth was a sphere. But their calculations of its size were somewhat inaccurate. They knew something of physics and mechanics enough to create the marvels of their engineering, such as the pyramids or the Roman aqueducts, achievements that are as impressive in their way as anything modern man has done. Indeed, much of the prestige of the modern hard sciences, chemistry, biology, physics, comes from the possibilities it creates for engineers. It wasn't science, per se, that built a refrigerator or a computer, a jet airplane or an automobile. It wasn't a scientist that invented laparoscopic surgical techniques or put a man on the moon. Engineers did that. Mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. It isn't scientists who invent a new drug. It's biochemical engineers. But so-called science basks in the prestige of the accomplishments of the engineers. That is itself an important fact. It reminds us that science, or learning, comes in all shapes and sizes. Everyone depends on every other one, including all manner of different areas of knowledge, all manner of different people doing all manner of different things. But there's something else. As you know, the history of science, because it is a human history after all, is riddled with frauds and fakes, with honest but serious mistakes, also with personal biases that pervert sound judgment, and as a result, with ever-changing conclusions. All manner of personal factors influence scholarly judgment. This is one of the most fascinating aspects of the story of biblical scholarship. At different times and places, different opinions about the Bible were touted as scientific, the assured results of scholarship. These things were what we now knew, it was said. The landscape of biblical scholarship is littered with the refuse of those once assured results of the scholarly guild that nobody accepts as true any longer. In fact, nowadays, you can see very easily where those opinions had come from. In German biblical scholarship in the 19th century, it was taught that the Hittites, mentioned a number of times in the Bible, were an invention. They never existed. Archaeology has now provided so many Hittite documents that Hittite scholarship is its own cottage industry. One of the most famous of all German biblical scholars in the 19th century, and perhaps the most influential, maintained that Moses could not have written the Pentateuch because writing hadn't been invented by the 14th century B.C. We've long since known that a sophisticated literary culture antedated Moses by more than 1,000 years. German biblical scholarship, you see, was shaped by an evolutionary theory of human development that required early society to be primitive, only gradually increasing in sophistication as the years passed. Much of its view of the Bible was shaped by that theory. One conclusion after another was drawn from that theory. Conclusions that have now been thrown into the dustbin of biblical scholarship. Interestingly, 19th century British biblical scholarship was much more likely to treat the history of the Bible as reliable and trustworthy. We don't ordinarily expect science, so-called, to come to one conclusion in Germany and another conclusion in Great Britain, but it has often, in fact, been the case. Another demonstration of how human learning actually is and how often it has been shaped by other things than the facts themselves. So what can we say about what science or the various areas of learning are to the study of the Bible? What does science know about the Bible? First thing we should say is that the general attitude of Bible-believing Christian scholars has always been welcoming of scientific inquiry. You will sometimes hear Christians say that we shouldn't let science dictate our understanding or interpretation of the Bible, and in one sense, that's surely right. We have every reason to be skeptical when scholarship claims that we cannot believe something we read in the Word of God. It has made far too many such claims that have been later discredited. What is more, if we have good reason to believe the Bible to be the Word of God, we have more reason to trust it than the ever-changing human opinions about this or that. But confident in the Bible as we are, and as we have reason to be, we want to learn everything we possibly can about the Bible, about its background, about its history, about its social, political, and literary context, and so on. Second, it's important for you to know that evangelical biblical scholarship, Bible-believing biblical scholarship, once overshadowed by the scholarship of the unbelieving type, is now as fully sophisticated and fully competent and holds its own in comparison to, if it does not surpass, liberal biblical scholarship in scholarly sophistication. In the first half of the 20th century, there were very few evangelical PhDs in the biblical sciences, and still fewer with a deserved international reputation. Now there are a multitude. some of the most authoritative historians of the ancient world, experts in the biblical languages, archaeologists, and so on, are believers in the historicity and the authority of the Bible. It's not the case that science knows or science has proved that the Bible is in error in this respect or in that. There may be scientists who claim the Bible to have been disproved. That's hardly the same thing. The issue, as we will see, is never that the smart people doubt the Bible and the dumb people believe it, much as unbelievers wish it were so or imagine it to be so. Biblical scholarship of the Bible-believing type is now really leading the way in the study of the Bible. Third, we've learned a great deal about the Bible. Our understanding of it has been wonderfully enriched and in some cases corrected by scholarly investigations or scholarly inquiry, often the inquiry of those who have no personal loyalty to the Bible. They're not Christians themselves. And there are literally countless examples of this. One, the Bible is written in ancient languages that we now understand better today than they were understood centuries ago due to the concerted effort of archaeologists, linguists, and lexicographers. Let me give you just one example, and there are hundreds of examples. The King James Version rendered the second half of Job 36, verses 32 and 33 this way. With clouds he covereth the light, and commandeth it not to shine by the cloud that cometh betwixt. The noise thereof showeth concerning it, the cattle also concerning the vapor. What in the world does that mean? Well, no one really knew. The translation of the Hebrew text that you have in the King James Version was the best they could do with the knowledge that they had. The ESV reads, he covers his hands with the lightning and commands it to strike the mark. Its crashing declares his presence. The cattle also declare that he rises. You can tell by the behavior of animals that a storm is coming. It's a statement about the hand of God, the mighty forces of nature, a presence that even the dumb animals recognize. We understand that verse because scholars have devoted themselves to the study of classical Hebrew and its related languages. That's learning, or if you will, that's science. And there are a great many advances like that. Think of our understanding of the Song of Songs that has been transformed by the study of ancient Near Eastern texts. Or think of the great advance in our understanding of the biblical presentation of God's covenants, since it was discovered that they are presented in Exodus and in Deuteronomy in the literary framework employed in the ancient Near Eastern political treaties. Or consider Psalm 93, verse 2, and its statement, the world is established, it shall never be moved. At one time, Christians thought that verse meant that the earth did not move through space, rather that the heavenly bodies moved around it. We not only now know that is not the case, we realize that such was never the meaning of the statement in the first place. It wasn't a statement about geophysical position. It was a statement about the faithfulness and the power of God. I could go on and on. Science has enriched, it has sometimes corrected our understanding of the language and the literature of the Bible. Or consider the solutions that learning, often the learned investigations of scholars who are not Christians, has provided for some vexing and long-standing problems of biblical interpretation. You may know, for example, that the numbers of the regnal years of Israel's kings, as they are given in the books of Kings and Chronicles, never added up. The years of a king's reign given in those books were not consistent with either other information in the Bible itself or with the chronological information gathered from ancient Near Eastern sources. And so it remained until scholarship, working both from the biblical side and the ancient Near Eastern history side, discovered that in that time and place, regnal years, as reported in official documents, regularly did not account for the overlapping reigns of both a father and a son, when, as often happened, a son began his reign while the father was still alive, but in effective retirement. Now all of that is very well understood. Today we know with almost perfect accuracy when each of Israel's kings reigned, when it began and when it ended, and along the way we have discovered that according to the conventions of political writing in that time, the biblical numbers are exactly reliable. Or consider the impossibly large numbers one regularly finds in the historical narratives of the Old Testament, which we once took literally, but now know are a feature of ancient Near Eastern prose style, or in certain cases may result from a mistranslation of the Hebrew word usually translated thousand, but which in military contexts may very well refer to a military unit of indeterminate and usually much smaller size. Learning or science has taught us that. Or consider individual discoveries that have illuminated one statement or another we find in the Bible. It was long thought, for example, that the reference to the two tables or tablets of the law in Exodus 34:1 and Deuteronomy 10:1 referred to the first four commandments, or sometimes the first five, those having to do with our duty directly to God, and the last six, those having to do with our duty to one another. We referred frequently to the first table of the law and the second table of the law, and meant by those terms the first four commandments and the last six. We now know from the researches of archaeologists, linguists, and historians of the ancient world that the two tablets are instead two separate copies of the summary covenant document, in this case, the Ten Commandments. One copy of which, in the ancient Near Eastern treaties, was deposited in each sanctuary, the sanctuary of the one king and the sanctuary of the other king. But in the covenant God made with Israel, both were deposited in the Ark of the Covenant, because God's sanctuary was Israel's sanctuary. I could go on and on and on with examples of how science or scholarly learning has illuminated and enriched and sometimes corrected our understanding of the Word of God. Egyptologists have given us a great deal of knowledge regarding ancient Egypt in biblical times, and some of the most prominent Egyptologists have been staunch evangelicals, such as the Liverpool University professor Kenneth Kitchen, who has written extensively on the precise accuracy of the biblical history. Alan Millard, who was Jack Collins' dissertation advisor, was a leading Assyriologist, and so on. Archaeologists have helped us to understand what Israel's life was like in ancient times. Linguists and literary scholars have helped us to notice features of Hebrew prose and poetry we never noticed or appreciated before. In all these ways, science or learning is nothing less than a gift of God. On the other hand, one who studies the Bible, as I do day after day, hears repeatedly that the Bible cannot be believed because we now know that such and such a thing never happened or couldn't have happened, or that such a statement derives from ancient Near Eastern mythology or some such thing. What are we to do with such claims? Should they shake our faith? Are such objections well taken? Let me say just a few things about those questions. First, there is now a very large body of highly competent, learned men and women who have made a lifetime's work of mastering one or more of the various disciplines of biblical scholarly endeavor, whose faith in the reliability, historicity, and truthfulness of the Bible remains unimpaired by the skepticism expressed by other scholars. They know full well what the objections to biblical authority or accuracy have been, how they have been raised by various scholars, and they remain entirely unpersuaded. Indeed, they have mounted impressive counterarguments that the biblical account commends itself to reasonable and unbiased judgment. Conclusions in any field of learning are often the result of a scholar's worldview more than an honest weighing of evidence. Anyone who's ever done a PhD knows that. I'm working my way through the book of Acts in the morning, as you know, and I read commentaries that are certain that Luke has manufactured a great deal of his story, certainly all the miraculous parts. But I also read commentaries, much more persuasive in my judgment, who have collected an immense amount of fascinating information and evidence demonstrating that Luke is an extraordinarily careful, sober, and accurate historian. In fact, the most accurate historian of any historian of the ancient world. It's a fact of history that Luke was accused many times of an error in detail that we now know was, far from an error, an instance of his precise accuracy. It turns out, for example, that Luke knew a great deal more about Greco-Roman political nomenclature than did 19th and 20th century German biblical scholarship. But more than that, his writing bears the indelible marks of historical seriousness and veracity. Luke told us he worked hard to get his facts right. And we have no reason, apart from prejudice against the supernatural, to doubt that he did. There's been a great deal of that prejudice at work in biblical scholarship, as you know, over the past several centuries. Rudolf Bultmann famously put it this way, as a man who lived in the age of the light bulb, he could no longer believe the Bible's account of the Lord's life, miracles, and resurrection. What difference the invention of the light bulb should make to the evaluation of New Testament history escapes me. Would an Egyptian historian have said, in the age of the pyramids, we cannot believe that the God of Israel is afflicting us with plagues? The contemporary German New Testament scholar, Gerd Ludemann, makes no bones about his viewpoint. He's happy to acknowledge it. Modern science has proved that dead men cannot rise. Modern science, of course, has proved nothing of the kind. The ancients knew very well that dead people didn't come back to life. That was precisely why the news of Jesus' resurrection so astonished them and why the news of it eventually turned the world upside down. Dead men do not come back to life. Unless the God who created those men and women and gave them life in the first place should bring them back to life. Second, for every argument, every specific argument against the truthfulness of the Bible, there are serious and responsible counter-arguments. The evangelical apostate New Testament scholar, Bart Ehrman, professor of New Testament at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, is famous for his efforts, about which he makes no bones, to undermine confidence in the reliability of the New Testament history. Some of his former students report that he tells his students in class that he intends to disabuse them of whatever confidence in the Bible they may still have left. He speaks very confidently to his students and his rapturous audiences, usually composed of people who very much want to believe what they know he's going to tell them about the Bible. But he does very little but reproduce claims not only familiar to evangelical scholarship, but utterly unimpressive to them. Ehrman does very much less well in a debate with evangelical scholars than you would think if you listened to him alone. What he trades in is much less the assured results of any biblical scholarship, but the opinions of a modern Western liberal. He published a book not long ago entitled Misquoting Jesus, The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. That sensational title, meant of course to sell the book, hides the fact that the book is actually about the textual criticism of the Greek New Testament, and contains nothing that scholarship hasn't known for centuries. But in large part, because of the title, the book was a New York Times bestseller for several months. To hear Ehrman The hundreds of thousands of textual variants in the manuscripts of the New Testament suggest that no one can really know what it was that Jesus or any other New Testament writer actually said or wrote. But almost any New Testament scholar of any stripe would point out that those several hundred thousand textual variants are spread over some 25,000 manuscripts, an average of some 16 variants per manuscript if there are 400,000 variants, some 8 variants if there are but, as is more likely, 200,000. But that doesn't sound so sensational. What is more, the majority of those variants are of interest only to specialists. They're minor copying mistakes, usually easily identified, or scribal alterations that do not affect the sense of the text at all. In fact, Ehrman knows this, and so as not to be savaged by his scholarly peers, he virtually admits this in the book, but not so clearly that his readers, uneducated in the history of the New Testament text, would gather that we have and have had for a long time a virtually perfectly reliable text of the New Testament. What is more, another point he doesn't make in the book is that all the really significant variants are honestly represented in the footnotes of almost all modern English translations of the Bible. No one thought that there was any need to hide this information from anyone, little difference as it actually makes. But if Ehrman has to misrepresent the facts to undermine the confidence of his readers in the textual integrity of the New Testament we have in our hands, whether a Greek New Testament or an English translation of it, surely that's some evidence that his argument itself is considerably less serious and considerably weaker than he wants us to believe it is. Ehrman has almost no influence in the scholarly guild, though he is widely popular in certain segments of the Christian world, or the once Christian world. Third, a common objection to the Bible's reporting of historical persons' events is based on a failure, what often seems to be a willful refusal, to read the Bible in a natural and literarily sophisticated way. They demand that the Bible speak in the style of 21st century English academic prose, or be held to the standard of modern scientific precision, and then accuse it of error when it fails to meet those standards, a standard that very few modern people, including scientists, meet in their ordinary conversation or writing. I once heard a professor at the University of Aberdeen admit that the Bible had errors in it, and his proof was that the dimensions of the great basin, or sea, which Solomon built to hold the huge amounts of water necessary for sacrificial worship in the temple, the dimensions provided in 2 Chronicles chapter 4, verse 2, provided an incorrect value for pi. The figures given, a diameter of 10 cubits and a circumference of 30 cubits, produce, as you know, a value for pi of 3. Obviously not the 3.14 we know pi to be. Phooey. The Bible hardly can be required to provide numbers in scientific precision. For that matter, 3.14 is only an approximation. I felt like raising my hand and saying I put no stock in the objection of a man who can't give a more accurate value for pi than 3.14. It's actually 3.14159265. If Luke mentions but one blind beggar outside of Jericho, and Mark mentions one and names him Bartimaeus, but Matthew says there were two blind beggars, who is to attribute to any gospel writer reporting error? If there were two, there was certainly one, the one of whom, known by name to Mark, clearly by the time the gospel was written, Bartimaeus was a member of the Christian community and known to be so, he understandably figures in the account. No reader of any historical account as concise as the Gospels are and must be has a right to insist that all the same details be reported in every account of the same event, so long as the report is true. There are examples of this by the score and more. No wonder believing biblical scholarship has been largely unimpressed by the efforts of other biblical scholars to bring reproach on the accuracy and trustworthiness of the Bible. I have to conclude. Let me say simply this. In a book as full of history as the Bible is, history that constantly intersects with history also known from other sources, there is not a single instance of a statement in the Bible that has been proved false. For a book written over so long a period of time and so long ago, a book so large, written by so many different men, and containing so much detail, names, dates, battles, eclipses, and so on. This is a remarkable thing to be able to say. Of course, I'm not denying that there are many people who will say that such a statement is false, this statement or that statement must be false. But in every case, there will be others, learned people, scientists, both believers and unbelievers alike, who will come to the defense of the Bible's account. My advice to anyone who is struggling with doubts brought on by claims that the Bible has been proved untrue or inaccurate or unreliable in this way or in that, my advice to them is to do at least this. Consult someone who is able to give you the other side of the story. Believe me, there will be another side to the story. Amen.